Just to check, how much time do we have?
As much as you want.
Well.
I suggest we can be here for an hour and a half, tops, so depending on how many people need to be for, so I believe as much as you want.
Okay. I'd like to, this is a case study, and it's a case study about Bankers Trust and the development of modern risk management. I think that there are two reasons that this is relevant, and it's relevant to think about this. Number one, I'll talk a lot about where basic concepts of risk management, or what we think of as the basic concepts of risk management, how they were developed, the context in which they were applied. In my opinion, it always helps to know how these things were initially developed, how they were initially applied. It helps us think about how they should be used, and it also helps us think about how they should be developed going forward. Second, we'll touch on the limits of risk management. Given that all of this, what I will talk about, really started in the 70s and 80s, the field of risk management was a well-defined field in the 1990s. Dan and I were talking over lunch that it really became defined as a field in the mid-1990s. So well in advance of the current crisis, we had lots of tools for risk management. But yet we still are mired in the deepest recession, the greatest financial crisis since the 1930s. What happened? What are the limits of these techniques? I've probably got enough information to talk straight for an hour and a half. I'd rather this be more of an interactive seminar, so you're welcome to interrupt me along the way and ask questions. I will start back kind of with my experience with Bankers Trust and try to bring it up to the mid-1990s, and then ask the question, what happened? If we had all of these techniques, why did we still stumble into the worst financial crisis since the 1930s? My memories of Bankers Trust date back to the mid-1980s. I was working at Wharton Econometrics. Specifically, I was involved in long-term forecasting for the U.S. economy. Those of you, this science has kind of was at its prime at that time. It's kind of declined in popularity, but the concept was short-term forecasting really tried to forecast business cycles. Long-term forecasting tried to identify the business cycles, but also the long-term trends. What could we reasonably say about the economy 10 years from now that really was insightful and helpful to people? I heard about Bankers Trust mainly because of interviews that the chairman, the president at that time, Charlie Sanford, and quotes from him in the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. I found his quotes to be interesting, extremely logical, and at the same time very challenging. What was unique was here was a president of a bank that was not afraid to make very clear, logical, compelling statements. He wasn't trying to defend the status quo. If anything, he was saying the banking industry needs to change. I made a point at that time to try to remember or try to read everything I could anytime he was interviewed in the press. And in my own mind, I put him in the same category of some other individuals that you may or may not have heard of. Walter Wriston, who was at Citibank. And if there's one individual that kind of was the leader, not only of Citibank, but the industry during the 1970s and early 1980s, it was Walter Wriston. And second, Alfred Herrhausen, who was the chairman of Deutsche Bank at that time. And it was Herrhausen that kind of led Deutsche Bank out of the period from the immediate World War II period to being a truly global institution. In all cases, I felt like these individuals had the ability to redefine the banking industry. So I was being exposed to Bankers Trust through the newspapers. I got interested in credit because if you really could forecast the U.S. economy, who should be buying this forecast? If I really felt convinced that there was value to what I was doing, that I really could say something meaningful, insightful, and accurate about the economy 5 years, 10 years from now, how should that be used? Bank economists were not interested. Bank economists were interested, were primarily involved in forecasting short-term interest rates. But I hit upon credit. Anytime you extend credit, you're writing a long-term contract. Normally these contracts, 3 years, 5 years, they can be much longer. They can be 10 years or 12 years. When you write that contract, it's based upon a forecast. Normally people think of it in terms of forecast of cash flows of the obligor, but behind that is also an economic forecast. So I asked a lot of chief credit officers at major financial institutions, if I could really provide insight or convince you that the economy was going to go into a recession in 18 months, what would you do differently than you're doing today? Every one of them said, thought about it, and said, I wouldn't do anything different. We are in the business of taking the risk of our customers, sharing the risk of our customers. That's what we do. During the 1980s, banking defaults rose to an all-time high in the United States. Over approximately 280 banks, I think, defaulted in the late 1980s. I said to myself, there's got to be a better way to address this problem. It turns out I was not alone. There were a number of other institutions. Bank of Montreal was very interested in this problem as well. We eventually got together and started sharing information. But Bankers Trust, of all the banks that I talked to, Bankers Trust was the only one that was interested and was actually thinking about the same problem. How do you manage the risk of this loan portfolio? It's a long-term book. There's very little liquidity. How do we manage that risk? So the seminar this afternoon is on Bankers Trust from the period 1970s to the mid-1990s. The key person that I will talk about is Charlie Sanford, who was started as the head of the trading operations, worked his way up to president and CEO of the bank. The primary theme that, if you don't remember anything else out of this, the primary theme of this is that every business must manage risk as well as return. And risk management should be every bit as much an offensive tool in the strategy of the firm as it is a defensive tool. I have not seen that practiced to the degree that it was practiced at Bankers Trust in any other institution. But it's something that I would always stress. Risk management is not purely defensive. It should be every bit as much an offensive tool. To put this in context, think about the financial services industry in the 1950s and early 1960s. During that time, the economic environment was extremely stable. The world was still recovering from World War II. The United States had not been damaged. The infrastructure had not been damaged. The U.S. industry was in an excellent position to provide products, exports to the world as it was rebuilding. Growth was relatively stable. We had very few recessions. We had fixed exchange rates, and interest rates were very low. The regulatory policies at the time had really come from the Depression of the 1930s. I'm sure you've heard many comments about Glass-Steagall and so forth. The basic point is that they were oriented toward control and stability rather than open markets and competition. That may be an issue that is revisited over the next 12 months in the United States. Financial services were divided into secure, insular sectors. And now, thinking about markets today, it's hard to realize that. Commercial banks controlled the loan business and the credit business. Savings and loan institutions provided savings products to consumers and mortgages. Investment banks had a virtual monopoly on underwriting and placement of securities. And the insurance companies offered products to manage specific categories of risk. There was very little competition, ability to compete across these different sectors. Banks were not allowed to underwrite securities. banks were not allowed to trade in certain products that might involve a crossover into the investment banking area. Commercial banking was a relatively simple industry at the time, a very simple industry. Looking at this is an aggregation of balance sheets of firms in 1950, or major banks in 1950. You can look at it, and 61% of the assets are cash or government securities, zero risk. The majority of the assets had zero risk. Demand deposits comprised 70% of the liabilities. Banks were not allowed to pay returns on demand deposits. If you include savings deposits in that, there was a cap on the interest that banks could pay. So you had 92% of the liabilities of banks with some kind of cap on the returns or the interest that the banks had to pay on them. Liquidity was obvious on the balance sheet. And the way banks made money was really in the category of business loans, mortgages, and consumer loans, where they actually were exposed to risk. And that's where the credit process had to focus. That's where they earned their returns. Today, of course, things look very, very different. Starting in the 1960s, the world began to change. And it changed, and many different things started happening to change the situation and make it increasingly uncomfortable to the commercial banks. First, the growth in the economy began to slow. There were a number of studies that looked at this. There was a lot of concern about productivity of labor. I think, basically, that there was growing competition. The economies of Europe and Asia were recovering. They were beginning to meet some of their own demand. There was less demand for U.S. products, and therefore slower growth began to kind of limit the upside opportunities and force more competition within the U.S. economy. At the same time, inflation began rising. We had the period of the late 1960s, which was the buildup of the Vietnam War. Taxes were not increased. Money was printed in order to finance the war. Inflation began to grow. When the war ended or began to taper down, inflation dropped, and then we had the first of two OPEC price shocks in the 1970s, when the price of energy quadrupled, I think, in both of those experiences. The experience on the inflation side was, of course, mirrored in terms of short-term interest rates and long-term interest rates, eventually leading to a 10-year Treasury yield of over 15% in the early 1980s. A couple of other things came together at the same time. Number one would be increasing competition on the liability side of the balance sheet. As interest rates led to greater competition with mutual funds. Mutual funds started to offer returns or interest payments on demand deposits. There were certain restrictions, but to the average consumer, this was a way of earning an interest or a rate of return on your demand deposits that commercial banks were not allowed to match. In 1980, the Monetary Control Act eliminated interest rate ceilings on demand deposits, and therefore freed banks to be competitive in terms of their demand deposits. But it also removed their advantage of having the cheapest source of funding, which was consumer savings. Increasing competition on the asset side happened in a different way. While the Monetary Control Act of 1980 encouraged competition, allowed banks to compete with mutual funds by removing the interest rate ceilings, there was no corresponding act that deregulated the asset side of the balance sheet. Instead, what happened there was kind of encroachment. Large corporates needed banks less and less. The commercial paper market began to develop. Large corporates could go directly to the market and raise short-term funding without needing a bank. So the role of the bank, the power of the bank, was reduced relative to their customers. Instead of providing a funded loan, which paid a fee plus a NIM, or net interest margin, the largest, the best customers of banks only wanted backup lines. And this was required by the rating agencies. If they were not able, if they ran into any trouble in the CP market, the rating agencies wanted them to be able to turn to their banks. So they took what's known as commercial paper lines of credit. We want to have a very large line of credit with the bank, but we're not likely to use it unless we get into trouble. And we're not going to pay you much because we're not drawing any money. So what happened was that all of a sudden, a primary source of income for the banks, the funded loan, declined dramatically in use. At the same time, the risk of that product, from a default risk standpoint, remained the same. The customer could always draw under that line. The bank was obligated to provide it. In most cases, there were very few covenants to prevent it from funding the loan if the customer wanted it. And the customer could default. So the risk remained the same, but the return dropped dramatically. Another important point that I think I've certainly seen in my lifetime is that the growth in the availability of information became very, very important. It used to be that banks, one of the most important things that really protected their market, their position, was the fact that they had information that wasn't available, information about their customer that was not available in the market. Over time, rating agencies stepped in and started rating more and more corporate debt. Customers started issuing more debt. Rating agencies started rating it, started publishing. The SEC required more disclosure of publicly traded companies, and all of a sudden there was a lot of information out there, which further undermined the position of banks in the market. Final point I'll mention very quickly was just globalization and the fact that regulatory practices in the 70s and 80s were not consistent across countries. They're not consistent today, but they were wildly inconsistent at that time, so that banks could come into the United States and offer services that domestic banks were not allowed to offer. And similarly, U.S. banks could go abroad and offer services that they couldn't offer at home, but there were limitations to scale and limitations to experience in being able to build that business. Final conditions I'll mention very quickly. One is advances in financial theory. A lot of the theory does eventually get into practice. I think that's especially true of finance. The two big contributions in the 1970s, the capital asset pricing model and the ability to value options. Computer technology kicked in a big way in the 1970s. I remember when I went to graduate school in the early 70s, you had to line up to get access to a mainframe computer. By the end of the 1970s, beginning of the 1980s, we had laptops. But another gigantic movement was the fact that laptops were moved from the back office to the front office. Traders could bring laptops to their desk before the institutions provided that computer technology available to them. They could sit there and program algorithms that they had studied or they were curious about. And this released a tremendous amount of creativity coming from average traders, average employees of banks. It was available to them almost overnight. Finally, the point at the top, and I think this is very true of Bankers Trust, there was a conscious realization that the world was becoming increasingly risky for all the reasons that we've talked about, and that if you're going to be successful, you have to learn how to understand risk, to measure risk, and manage risk. And the bank set out to think about that. Moving on to the next section of this, Bankers Trust was at best, a second-tier performer in the 1970s. The primary banks in the United States were Morgan Guaranty, Citibank, Chase Manhattan, and the old Bank of America. Bankers Trust was probably sixth or seventh in terms of asset size. It did not have a particularly competitive product mix or product offering. There's a tremendous tendency, and Bankers Trust was guilty of it, of following the leader in banking, herd behavior. The big boom that had occurred in the late 60s, early 70s was real estate. Bankers Trust announced in the early 1970s that it wanted to be the real estate bank, which was fine until the recession of 1973-74 occurred. And as the caption at the top, one analyst referred to them as a lemming that nearly drowned. They did not have breadth of products, and their financial statistics, whether you look at return on assets, return on equity, or price earnings ratio, lagged the peer group significantly in all cases. However, there was one part of the bank that began to show promise, and this was what was called the Resources Management Department. Now, Resources Management is a strange name to associate with a department. This was the precursor of the trading floor, the trading department. At the time, they were responsible for funding the bank, managing the bank's investment account, trading selected products, foreign exchange, government bonds, municipal bonds, and certain short-term financial instruments. They could not touch corporate bonds. They were not allowed to touch long-term financial instruments and so forth. So there was a very limited set of tools that they could use. But during the 70s, this group began to post significant improvements in their performance. Between 77 and 1980, their returns, their revenue, increased fourfold. This was picked up by Business Week and noted. Business Week used to do a section every year on looking at industries. They may still do it, and ranking the top performers in each industry. By 1981, on an ROE basis, Bankers Trust was at the top. And it was at the top because of the Resources Management Department and the fact that nothing else was going wrong in the rest of the bank. The key behind this was the development of new techniques to measure and manage risk. I'd like to spend a few slides sharing with you kind of how this got started and the concepts, how it was initially applied. Charlie Stanford had started his career in corporate banking, commercial lending. At some point, he switched to join the Resources Management Department. I guess in 1973 or 74, he switched to join Resources Management. By 74, 75, he was head of Resources Management. As he was walking out of the building one day, he ran into a fellow trader. They stopped and talked briefly, and Charlie said, "How'd you do today?" And the guy said, "Brought him in, shot him out, didn't make any money." They said goodbye and went home. That comment stuck in Charlie's mind, not because it was particularly insightful, but probably because it was extremely shallow. The real issue was, how should we think about the performance of a trader? How should we measure their performance? Should we look for a relative measure or an aggregate measure? How should we think about the performance of the bank as a whole? And if there's one thing I would encourage you to do throughout your career, always back up and ask that question, how should it be done? Many, many times we're limited by our experience and the procedures that surround us, and we never back up and say, what's the right way to think about this problem? I told Mr. Sanford that one time many years later, and he said, I told him that one thing I remembered about Bankers Trust and really respected was that whenever you went into a meeting, you'd sit down and say, now what's the right model for this problem? How should we think about this problem? He said, Gene, you have no idea how long it took me to get the bank to that point that they would ask that question. So Charlie thought about what should the trader have said? What was he really looking for? Or what would have been helpful to him for the trader to say? He hit upon three concepts that are well known in finance, but had never really been integrated into a single approach. First, by taking a position, by buying bonds, the trader was bringing risk into the bank and using the bank's capital. If those bonds had defaulted at any time, or if they were government bonds, if they had declined in value at any time, it would have been a hit to the bank, it would have been a potential hit to the capital of the shareholders. So by doing a deal, by bringing exposure into the bank, this trader was using the bank's capital. Second, the only reason anyone should ever do that is the expectation of earning a return. And if you're taking more risk, your expectation of return should be higher. And third, to justify the use of shareholders' capital, the trader's expectation of risk must be equal to or greater than the returns that the shareholder could get elsewhere in the market. If the trader were doing a great job of bringing in risk into the bank but was not earning sufficient returns to keep that capital satisfied in the bank, the shareholder would take it somewhere else. So these three concepts are really the basis, in my mind, of modern risk management. Using these principles, the key is the explicit introduction of risk into decision-making in the firm. Using these principles, you're then able to relate the trader's behavior in terms of taking a position or selling a position all the way through to the shareholder's expectation for his capital. And the challenge is to align this behavior so that traders have the incentive to do the things that earn high returns, sufficient returns for the shareholders. Capital held against, now, capital means many, many different things. And I think almost every discipline has its own definition, or discipline in economics and finance has its own definition of capital. Sanford had to come up with his own definition of capital. What he wanted was a measure of the risk to the firm. So he called that economic capital. Very quickly, I'm sure you're all familiar with this, but if there's one thing that Sanford is probably proudest of in his career, it's the concept of RAROC. Simply looking at the return on a product, or the risk-adjusted return on a product, compared to the economic capital that you have to hold against that position, you come up with a concept known as risk-adjusted return on capital. In Sanford's mind, economic capital is a proxy for shareholder investment, shareholder equity. So if the bank can maximize the return on economic capital, it will maximize return on equity. He set about instilling this theory into the bank. The key behind this, we can measure return. That's not a problem. Clearly, the critical issue in this simple formula is economic capital. How do you specify it? How do you measure it? That was the significant contribution of Bankers Trust, and today, in my mind, that's the heart of modern risk management. What is the economic risk that we're facing? Again, I suspect all of you have some exposure to RAROC. Has anyone not been exposed to it? very quickly, though, just to bring you through how I might have felt when I first walked into the bank in the late 1980s. Assume that you face three traitors. And when this example was put together about 3 years ago, it was during the presidential elections in the U.S. We had John earned a certain amount of money trading government bonds. Hillary had a little bit more risky platform. She was trading high-yield bonds. And Barack was trading investment-grade corporate bonds. They all earned different money. But at the end of the year, how do you compensate them? Which one did the best from the perspective of the shareholder? This is the way that Rayrock is normally introduced or talked about within among the Bankers Trust alumni. How do you determine which of these individuals not only deserves the highest compensation, but did the best, was most productive with the bank's capital? If I just look at return, I can't really make a meaningful comparison. If I attach an economic capital number to that, I can easily compare returns relative to economic capital and come up with the insight that Barack generated 23% return on the economic capital that he used. So according to this simple example, once I introduce risk explicitly into the evaluation process, I can discriminate across different behavior that I could not do otherwise. The critical question then became, how do I measure this concept of economic capital? Now remember, we didn't have, when Stanford was developing this in 74, 75, it didn't come from Basel. Basel didn't exist. He was trying to solve a very practical problem, real world problem that he faced. He was on the trading floor, so this applied to traded products. And I emphasize liquidity, I emphasize mark-to-market, market value, market prices. So in Stanford's mind, what he was interested in is minimizing the losses that might occur from, say, bond spreads. How much money can I lose in a short term? And what's the critical time period? He asked himself, what's the critical time period that he should be thinking about that? He hit upon the idea of, I want to hold enough money, make sure I have enough capital for my trading operations so that I can protect the bank or protect my P&L against losses until I can get out of those positions. So the answer to the second question is he wanted to determine for each product or each trade how long would it take to get out of that position. That was a very subjective thing that came from the employees themselves or from the managers. And it's probably important to realize that in subjectivity is a critical element of risk management. In the end, it can't be eliminated. The worst you can do is to assume it away. It is there, it should be recognized. So what Stanford was saying is, given bond spreads, what's the most that I can lose in a period of time before I can get out of that position? And normally he was talking about something less than 5 days. So he's not going to hold a position that he can't get out of in 5 days. And he looked at bond spread information, which was published on the back of a weekly sheet that came out of Salomon Brothers at that time, and said the maximum loss in value of bonds by rating category that can occur, that have occurred in the post-World War II period, is X. So I'm going to use that as my risk measure. Now we end up with three or four different concepts of capital. I'll just mention very briefly, it's helpful sometimes to think about existing capital versus required capital. Existing capital is capital such as book capital, which is measured by accountants according to accounting rules. Market capital is the market capitalization that's determined in the market. Regulatory capital is the capital that's determined according to the Basel rules. Economic capital is different from all of these. Economic capital is the capital you hold to protect the firm against severe losses, what came to be known as unexpected losses. So economic capital becomes a required concept, a term, the amount of capital required to protect the bank, whereas the other three concepts are existing. The takeaways from this very quickly, the big contribution was the explicit introduction of risk into decision making. And by doing that, the interests of the individuals who manage the bank's capital can be aligned to the interests of the individuals who own the bank's capital. And if you can align that, you're sending very clear messages to the line in terms of what's good business and what's bad business from the standpoint of the shareholder. And as long as they play by the rules, as long as you set up the business culture and business governance standards to play by the rules, then you can empower the staff to transact with a great deal of independence, as long as they stay within certain bounds or limits. Concept of economic capital is critical. It is the core part, core element of modern risk management. As we'll talk about in a minute, economic capital came to mean the maximum losses that can be sustained by a bank over a defined period of time, usually 1 year, at a very high probability. So we want to protect the bank against losses up to a 99.9% probability over a 1 year horizon. Interesting point, the final bullet point is an interesting point. It used to be that if a trader bought a position and sold the position at the same price, either today or a month from today, he didn't make any money. Once you consider RAROC, that's no longer the case. If you buy something today at a price and sell it tomorrow at the same price, you've earned a negative return for the shareholder. You've used the shareholder's capital for a period of time, you have returned zero return, whereas the shareholder could have put that capital somewhere else. So if you think about it in those terms, the world is no longer the same once you introduce the concept of economic capital. Any questions at this point? Yes?
Just a question. How did you convince the manager that market was
going to be? That's a great question. And one of the things that I don't really delve into in the paper that much is how difficult it is to change a corporation. Charlie succeeded because he rose to be chairman, is the simple answer. And most of the people, and I don't mean this in a ruthless way, but most of the people that opposed him left, were forced out. It was a radical change for a commercial bank to say, we don't think we're maximizing shareholder value by doing what other people are doing. A great quote in the paper is that someone said, there are many employees in the bank that wanted to embrace this, that wanted to be part of the new bank, the new culture. They didn't know how to do it. They would bring in business, and Bankers Trust would say, no, this is exactly what we don't want to do. But then that business would go across the street to Chemical Bank or Manihani at that time, and they would gladly do it. So the industry was embracing it, but Bankers Trust, Charlie Stanford, was saying, no, that's not what we want to do. So it was a very, very trying time, really. And I don't think bankers made a lot of friends among the peer institutions because they wanted to be different. And they told analysts that they wanted to be different. Any other questions? Okay, the remaining topics that I would like to cover are application of RAROC to lending products, the evolution of the RAROC model, how it got incorporated into the culture of the bank, innovation risk and reputation risk, and finally, the performance of the bank during this time. I'll touch on each of these topics fairly lightly. If there are any questions, please let me know. Thinking about loans, Sanford realized that lending comprised about 70% of a bank's assets. Well, by the time, credit risk was about 70% of the total risk faced by the bank. So if this concept of RAROC, risk management, was to really make a significant contribution, it had to, in some way, embrace loans. Loans presented a particular problem. Think about the following. Here's a typical loan. Borrower, Corrosion Incorporated, credit rating, committed limit, $300 million, expected utilization, 100%, term to maturity, 5 years, spread, LIBOR plus 23. Clearly, this example was made up before the crisis. That spread today would be probably LIBOR plus 150. How do you think about the risk-adjusted return on this loan? What's the exposure? What's the maximum time to get out of the position? There are lots of issues in this. One of them is accounting. Loans are traditionally treated on an accrual basis. So it's treated at par with no price fluctuations unless it's deemed to be impaired. Unless somebody in the bank, normally a credit officer, says, I don't think we're going to get paid back in full. And then we have to put a provision on the loan. So I get no price information, I get no daily price information out of that position. I can't measure volatility on that position. I can't measure price fluctuation. I can no longer think about the maximum loss in a 3 to 5 day period. Equally critical was the issue of loans were traditionally illiquid. I might be able to sell part of it, but I'd probably risk the entire relationship with the customer if I did it. So I originated a loan with the intent of holding that to maturity. Sanford simplified the world in his own mind, and he said, loans and bonds are simply IOUs. If I take out a loan, I owe you some money. If I issue a bond and you buy it, I owe you some money. Both of them are the same. So for those corporates that issued bonds, he could look to the bond and get some information about price volatility, daily price volatility from the bond, and estimate how long it would take to get out of that position. So that's where his thought process started. But then Sanford, around 1984, got promoted to be president of the bank. And I'll just say very quickly, without getting sidetracked on this, one of the reasons he was promoted to be president was that resources management had done well. It had turned out to be an engine of growth for the bank. Second, the other part of the bank, the commercial banking side, had done poorly. Has anyone guessed what happened in the early 1980s?
Recession.
There was the recession. There was also the LDC crisis. In 1982, Mexico basically defaulted on its debt. 27 other countries followed after that. The current crisis is not the first time the American, the U.S. banking system has been basically in default. If they had been forced to mark their loans to market in 1983, 84, 85, most of the banks, large banks in the U.S. would have been insolvent. The regulators stepped in at that time and said, you are not allowed to mark down your LDC debt. You must carry it at par. Everybody knew that it wasn't worth par. But number one, they wanted to avoid an international problem, international unrest. And number two, they wanted to give banks the time to build reserves so they could pay it back. In 1987, they allowed this debt to trade. Nobody knew what it was going to trade at, the right prices. And it took 3 years before the banks were able to write it off finally in 1989. Bankers Trust ended up, I've forgotten the number, writing off 1.5 or 2 billion US dollars of LDC debt. Now, that's nothing compared to 50, 60, 70 billion that you hear about today, but it was extremely big at that time. So Sanford did not have any recent experience on the lending side of the business. While he was a very atypical banker, most bank CEOs, presidents, had come from the corporate lending side. Sanford was the first bank president that came from the trading side of the bank. Dennis Weatherspoon at J.P. Morgan subsequently came from the trading side or treasury side of that bank to become CEO. But Sanford was the first trader to rise in the corporate structure. The problem then, going back to this slide, the problem with Sanford's approach to measuring the risk of loans was that all banks do not issue corporate bonds, and loans come in many different shapes and sizes. There is the term loan, where I give you $100 and you agree to pay me back, either over time or at a point in time. There's also the revolving credit line, which I say you may borrow up to $100, and you can use it, pay it, draw it down to $100, or pay it back as you wish during that period of time. There are letters of credit and financial guarantees and so forth. So there are many different types of credit lines, and they don't all fit into this bond analogy. By this time, Sanford had moved up in the organization, but he remained interested in this risk management because it was, he thought, the key to transforming the bank and the key to building a profitable bank for the long term. He hired a couple of PhDs, which was novel at that time. He hired Dan Borgi from Harvard, and basically Borgi's job was to work on the problems that Sanford didn't have time to work on. And risk management was one of them. Thinking about loans, so one of the first things Borgi turned to was, how do I apply RAROC to the lending product? I listed several different issues that had to be addressed: the accounting issue, liquidity, absence of market prices. There was strong resistance from the regulatory community to fair valuing or thinking about fluctuations in prices of loans. This is just not something that is done. And second, there was strong resistance within the firm, because here's this trader, this hotshot trader coming from, at that time, downtown, to tell the corporate bankers, which is the lifeblood, the backbone of the banking industry, how they should do their business. So there was a lot of resistance to this within the firm. Borgi eventually took an approach somewhat similar to what Sanford was working on. He said, first, I want the credit officers involved in this process. The best way to be successful is to involve the people that oppose you and get them involved in the negotiations and get them to be part of the solution. So he wanted the credit officers to be involved in the process, but he wanted a minimum amount of information from them. The problem was, the more that he asked from them, the less he was likely to get. So he said, okay, just reduce it down to a credit rating. I want you to rate every obligor for every facility in the bank. Now, bank ratings are a common thing today. They were not in the early 1980s. I do not think Bankers Trust was necessarily the first bank to start ratings. This is when Moody's and S&P started growing their business in terms of bond ratings, also during the early 1980s. But Sanford felt like, because there were corporate bond ratings did exist, he could ask them for this rating. Boogie went one step further than other banks then, and he built this into a risk management system. He said, I'm going to take, if you rate this firm, this obligor, as a triple B, I'm going to go look at all of the triple B bonds, corporate bonds out there. I'm going to measure the price volatility on those bonds, and I'm going to associate that volatility with that triple B customer. So he's looking to the bond market to get pricing information to price an instrument that does not trade in the market. Second, he used that to calculate the amount of economic capital. And he looked at the term to maturity of the instrument when he measured the volatility. So what's the price volatility of this AAA corporate bond over a 3-year period, over a 5-year period? And using this, he was able to construct, you know, the bond spread would include not only the mark-to-market or market risk of the instrument, but it would also include the market's view of default risk of the instrument. So he was able to calculate a RAROC from that. The approach, Sanford loved it. The people that were opposed to it felt like it was absolutely stupid. I mean, here's somebody comparing loans to bonds. Nobody had ever done that before. Just because it's not been done doesn't mean it shouldn't be done. But they were able to prevail. What really was the contribution here is it enabled Bankers Trust to compare the risk of lending products with the risk of traded products, the two fundamental divisions of the bank. The concept could then be applied to other businesses within the bank. And all of a sudden, what you've done is to reduce every business to a risk-return concept. And you can put them in the same model and make comparisons. Now, it is when you think about the lending portfolio, the backbone, the core product of banks, the reason that commercial banks exist. There were many people that said, oh, this can't be the most risky product that we offer. It can't be an unattractive product because that's why we exist, is to provide this product. What Sanford and Borky were able to show is that it was extremely high risk and it was extremely low return compared to other uses of the bank's capital. And one of the main reasons for that is loans are long-term contracts. You make a decision today and you don't control what's going to happen over the next 5 years. There used to be a view that a good credit officer could pick a customer today and feel confident that it's not going to default over 5 years. But a lot can happen over 5 years that you have no clue of. You can't incorporate that into your decision making today. So, one, these are long-term contracts. Two, they tend to be very large. And three, they're illiquid. At the conclusion of this, I'd like to give you a problem to think about. Don't let me forget about it, thinking about how you might manage a loan portfolio. So before I go to this slide, the basic concept is that using this risk management technique of looking at risk and return, fundamental concepts from modern finance, that really, I guess, go back to Markowitz in the early 1950s, Sanford was able to make comparisons across returns, shareholder returns, from different products. That was big. And that enabled him eventually to drive capital away from the low return businesses to the high return businesses within the bank. Another big contribution, and this came from Dan Borky. Sanford had always thought about risk in terms of maximum price loss within a period of time before I could get out of the position. Borky came along and said, why don't we think about it in terms of a distribution? And for a traded product, my expected loss is zero. But I know that this is stochastic, so I have a chance of upside and a chance of downside. I want to hold enough capital to protect the bank against losses to a certain confidence level. 98% is what was used initially at Bankers Trust for the traded business. So that became, Bankers Trust called this Market Rayrock. They developed it in 1979-1980, and they were using this to control the maximum exposure of their traded positions. This later was, same concept was introduced by J.P. Morgan in 1995 and called Value at Risk, and that's the way we know it today. Over time, this concept has been applied to different categories of risk. These graphs are illustrative. Market risk tends to take a bell shape. Credit risk, as you know, is skewed, fat tail skewed distribution. There are other types of risk. Risk management practices within banks, and as required by Basel now, try to put it all together to look at a risk profile facing the bank and requiring the bank to hold economic capital to protect a credit rating up to a certain confidence level. So all of this came from that concept of a trader saying, I brought him in and shot him out and didn't make any money today. Capital adequacy. Risk capital was always perceived by Sanford as well as the regulators as a promising concept for regulatory practice. There's a very, very real, several very real trade-offs involved in that concept. First is you need it to be comprehensive if you're going to use it for a regulatory concept. And second, it must be simple enough to implement so that you can really feel confident that you're measuring according to the rules. Sanford did communicate these practices with the New York Fed very early in the 1980s. By 1986, there were memos that he had written to Paul Volcker, who was head of the Fed at that time, encouraging the regulators to think about these concepts. The Basel Accord then came out in 1988. It accepted the general concept of risk capital, but it differed from the Bankers Trust recommendations in two ways. One, the calculation of capital for lending products did not consider differential risk factors for different obligor groups. It did make the distinction between governments, financial institutions, and corporates. But it did not make the distinction between AAA, AA, single A, triple B. There was some question as to why that happened. What I was told is it was probably because the regulators were not willing at that time to make a distinction between credit quality of sovereign governments. So they lumped all the OECD countries together, all the developed economies, and said, you guys are clean, no risk here. Here's the emerging markets, you guys have got some risk here. But they weren't willing to go that next step and differentiate the risk quality of sovereigns, and consequently they weren't willing to go the next step to differentiate the risk quality of corporates. Second, market risk capital was completely eliminated or omitted for fear that it was too complex, too much, too fast. Both of these issues have been addressed. Market risk was introduced in 1995 into the Accord, and in the late 1980s, the Basel II proposals came out, which called for differentiation of credit quality of lenders, of obligors. Great quote from John Drzik and Oliver Wyman. All major banks today use some variant of RAROC and economic capital in their business. No bank that has ever adopted RAROC and economic capital has ever dismantled it. I have sat in on many different conferences and heard senior risk managers speak. There was one institution about 5 years ago that said, we do not calculate economic capital, we do not believe in abstract models, and we feel that we're running our business very well. They continue to do well up until this crisis, and today they're one of the worst performers. This is not a U.S. bank, but a European bank. One of the worst performers overall. Think with me briefly for a moment about RAROC as a competitive tool and how Sanford went about incorporating this into the culture of the bank and driving the evolution of the bank. We talked about incorporating RAROC into applying RAROC to lending products. Lending products represented about 70% of the total risk taken by a bank, so it was essential to get something established in that area. They were able to show that in general, lending products generated very low returns on capital and therefore were a poor use of the bank's capital. The response to that was, there were several responses to that. One, when we originate a loan, we get paid an origination fee. We get paid for doing the due diligence, et cetera, and the documentation. So Sanford said one way to approach this is just do more loans and get paid more upfront fees. That's fine, but you've got a limited amount of capital, and you have to have hold capital against those products. So you can't simply continue piling on loans. You can't simply continue piling on risk. So the answer to the problem was, why don't we distribute some of these loans? After all, isn't that what investment banks do when they underwrite securities? They don't have to hold securities. They don't underwrite a bond issue for IBM and hold all of it. Their role is to distribute it. Why can't we do the same for loans? There was a cute story that the head of the lending business told me when I interviewed him. He said he took a couple of his senior credit officers out to dinner one night and said, we need to think about, I want to talk about selling loans, and I want to know your honest opinion. Do you think we can start selling loans off of our balance sheet? And both of them said, no, I don't see how we can do it. They went through the dinner, and when the check came, the guy picked up the check and he said, listen, I don't care what your opinion is. We're going to start selling loans, and you've got till tomorrow morning to tell me whether you want that job or whether you want to look for another job. They did start selling loans, and what happened, I don't want to, if there are questions, I'll be glad to go into this. Most of the large investment loans to large investment grade customers, as I said, are largely unfunded. They are originated at a discount. So to sell that loan, the bank would have to incur a loss. Loans to highly leveraged companies, LBOs, tend to be fully funded. There are very strict covenants in the loan documentation. Banks are much more powerful in drafting that documentation to protect themselves. So Bankers Trust gravitated away from lending or putting in place backup lines to customers to lending in the LBO market. Because these loans are properly priced or reasonably priced, they are very attractive to asset managers and other investors. So the bank was able to develop a distribution network to place loans in the market. And that's where the secondary loan market was. That's how the secondary loan market was developed. So they reduced lending to investment grade customers, focused on the leveraged loan market. Ideally, in their mind, in Bankers Trust mind, they wanted to be able to underwrite, to be honest, underwrite and distribute 100% of a loan, just like an investment bank does with a corporate bond or an equity position. And Sanford was very outspoken in the press, saying that no investment bank has ever gone bust by underwriting a security. And look at all the defaults that are occurring in the banking industry because we have to hold these, because we're holding these loans. Now that was a tough sell both within the institution as well as within the industry. And I think he was generally successful in the leveraged loan area. He was not successful in the investment grade area. As another example of pushing RAROC within the institution, in the 1970s and 1980s, products like cash management, various processing businesses, were always treated as an appendage to lending, something that the bank did for the customer in order to protect the lending business. A fundamental part of RAROC is that you need to identify the risk and return of each product. So if the bank was providing a cash management product, Sanford wanted to know what's the risk and return on that product. He pulled that out and put it all together in a single business unit called ProfitCo. It gave the managers control over cost, pricing, and design. They were told to be competitive within the industry and to realize that this is their business. They're no longer an appendage to cling onto the lending business. Besides, lending was not a very profitable business anyway. One of the big things is that it forced the relationship managers to redefine their understanding of their jobs, and he wanted them to think of themselves much more as underwriters rather than as somebody that simply sits on a relationship, because it's very difficult to manage to measure the return on a relationship. The concept of a return on a product or transaction is much better, much easier. I mentioned capital management, and this is really fundamental. Sanford used RAROC to be able to identify high return businesses, low return businesses within the bank, risk adjusted returns. And he moved capital from the low returns to the high return businesses. And that meant transforming the bank. It meant basically saying, I don't care that you've been in lending all of your life and that you've built your career and you now manage a staff of 25 people. There's going to be less capital associated with this business going forward, and this business is going to shrink. And he moved it toward higher return businesses. Most of them were associated with trading. No product fit Bankers Trust strategy better than derivatives. And in this context, derivatives at this time were a new product. They were almost an area of extreme creativity. They could easily be redesigned, repackaged, refocused to meet a client's specific needs, and it seemed like they were endless in terms of what could be done with them. The argument was that by pulling risk apart, rather than saying the risk of this product, what we wanted to do was to take risk, the risk of the product, and divide it into interest rate risk, credit risk, liquidity risk, and any other risk that might be associated with it. And then we could repackage those elements of risk into something that an investor was interested in. We could strip out components of risk that an investor was not interested in. And Bankers Trust pioneered this business. If you go back and read the literature, it was involved in virtually every major derivative development to a point. And I will admit that while they dabbled in credit derivatives, and were probably one of the early firms that tried to develop a derivative credit derivative product, they walked away from it around 1993, and J.P. Morgan then focused on it, and J.P. Morgan developed the products that we now know today as credit derivatives. Innovation risk and reputation risk. There's no question innovation is the engine that drives growth in a market economy. It carries the potential for great returns for the innovative firm. It also carries significant risk. It carries significant reputation risk. Every time you develop a new product, I mean, you'd like to think that if there's no rule against it, you should be able to do it. But you never know how that product's going to be used. You never know how the investor is going to view that product. And you turn it over to a salesperson who's incentivized to sell it, and you're not sure that it is all of that is disclosed to the investor. So Bankers Trust ran into some problems with its leveraged derivatives business in the mid-1990s. There were two specific cases, and this is widely documented. In one case, Bankers Trust admitted that the salesperson had not properly represented the risk or not properly made proper representations to the customer, and they agreed to pay a $10 million fine. In the second case, Bankers said, we have reviewed all of our information, we are not aware of anything that we have done wrong, and we're prepared to litigate this. And that litigation drug on for at least a year, probably 18 months. Sanford retired, and his predecessor then settled that case. It was settled without any admission of guilt or wrongdoing. So when I look back at the case, And when I look back at the entire situation, Bankers ended up paying a fine of $10 million and without ever admitting guilt. When you compare that to the fines that have been paid, and it admitted that its traders had not represented the risk correctly to one customer. But when you compare that to the size of the fines that have been going on in the last 5 years, that's very much under the radar screen, far under the radar screen. I think that there are analogies that can be drawn between exotic derivatives, leveraged derivatives, and the structured credit products that were the epicenter of the current crisis. In terms of the complexity, they're being abstract, and questions of whether the investors really understood what they were taking when they took those positions. So the fundamental point that I would just leave you with is that there is, while innovation is critical to long-term profitability and success in any business, there is reputation risk associated with that. And it's very, very difficult to anticipate how those products are going to be used when they're out in the market. In summary, I've talked about how Sanford tried to reduce the size of the loan portfolio. When Sanford took over as chairman, when he took over as president, the loan portfolio was 60% of the total assets of the firm. When he retired as chairman in 1995, they were 12%. That's how dramatic the transformation of the bank was. And you can see almost every year that number came down. And you can think of somebody behind that pushing to drive the firm in a different direction. At the same time, non-interest income, trading income, grew significantly during that era. I've not done this slide for the peer banks. I would be interested in doing it, namely to see, and my guess is that Bankers Trust preceded the other banks in terms of switching from a lending bank to a non-lending bank or a trading bank. But I would be interested to see how quickly the other institutions followed behind that. One critical thing, there are a lot of firms today that realize that loans are not necessarily good investments or good use of banks' capital. The critical issue that they face is that if they reduce lending, they reduce revenue, period. They don't have other products. Bankers Trust had other products coming from the trading side, and they pioneered or pushed the derivatives business, one, because it was extremely good business, but two, they wanted to reduce the returns on the loan side, move capital out of loans. So in order to make that transformation, you've got to have something to take. If you're reducing activity in one area, you've got to have something to step in and fulfill that. If you think about global banks, and not to pick on anyone in particular, but the Japanese banks are very big lenders. And while I've talked to many of them about the concentration risk that they hold, the credit risk they hold on their balance sheets, it's very difficult for them to argue that they should hedge that risk because it's just money out the door. They don't have anything else to use that capital for other than to make another loan. And I think longer term what we're going to see is all of the world's banks, the large global banks, trying to develop a more diversified platform, product platform, so that they can have the ability to move capital from one market to another. Bankers Trust returns. I had originally said that Sanford was driven, interpreted economic capital as shareholder capital, and by maximizing returns on economic capital, he thought he could maximize returns to shareholders. ROE in the bank had moved along around 10% between 1966 and the late 1970s. It took a significant jump in the early 80s, and when Sanford became chairman, it averaged 20% during his tenure as chairman. That's good for any firm. much less a bank. Now, this was the time when he had the problems with leveraged derivatives. He did not lose the poor performance that year is largely associated with losses that were incurred in Latin America. No particular reason other than somebody made some mistakes and they were not caught. But he did not feel there were no losses incurred or annual losses incurred because of derivatives behavior. Compared to the peers, I mentioned that the average return on equity was 20% for Bankers Trust. This was better than any other bank, commercial bank. It was exceeded by Morgan Stanley and Bear Stearns during the period 86 to 95. And in all probability, if Bankers had not run into problems with in 95, they would have exceeded those two as well. Now, takeaways from all of this. Risk management is fundamentally important. It's not just a defensive tool. Please think of it as an offensive tool, at least as important as a defensive tool. Firms that are informed, firms that understand risk and manage risk can make informed and conscious decisions when they want to embrace risk and when they want to shed risk. They can establish a more accurate buffer to protect against losses. How much capital should be held? All too frequently, firms may end up holding too much capital because they can't size the risk properly. They can charge a better price or a more accurate price for risk. Nothing will pull a firm down faster than mispricing risk at origination. It can align incentives for the people that manage capital with those that own capital. And it can move capital around from low-return businesses to high-return businesses. I did talk briefly about transformation of the corporate structure, culture. This is a very, very big issue. If you ever talk with people that have been through something like this, it's extremely difficult to transform a corporate structure. In my experience, after I left Bankers Trust and went to Deutsche Bank, we went through a similar situation where we were generally a commercial bank based in Germany, and we made the decision to develop an global investment bank. Many strategies failed. It wasn't until 1995-96 that it had the leadership and it had the will to stick behind the leadership to develop the global bank. Today, I'd say Deutsche Bank is a global bank, and we function as a global institution. So we've adopted many of the concepts that were developed at Bankers Trust, but it has been a very interesting, challenging, fun time, but it's also been a very tiring time in terms of knowing that the bank is going to change, and you never know. The bank's going to move resources from underperforming areas to higher performing areas and put business first, basically, in spite of careers, in spite of individuals. A quote from the Prince concerning, "Nothing is more difficult to carry out, more doubtful of success, nor more dangerous to handle than to initiate a new order of things." Let's go back to our example on bank loans. Consider this loan, $300 million, 100% utilization, 5 years, at a spread 23 basis points over LIBOR. A week after this loan is booked, a credit derivatives trader comes along and says, "I can hedge this loan at 18 basis points." Forget about regulatory capital for a moment. Should the bank do this deal? Should the bank hedge this loan? You're not asleep. You've got a 50-50% chance of getting it right. Sanford would say, absolutely. Hedge the loan, free the capital, redeploy the capital, and go out and earn something on top of that. I'm either stuck with 23 basis point return, or I can hedge that, retain my 5 basis points, and then go earn 23 more basis points on top of that. Yes?
The other way I look at it is if you create 8 basis points, you have like what was 5 basis points, and you can compare it to a government bond, because it's a credit risk in it. So you're earning respect for the government.
Well, you're insured of that, aren't you? I mean, that's the bet.
Yes, any guy would do it, even if I didn't deploy the capital elsewhere, just by comparing it to a government bond.
Well, I could deploy the capital to a government bond, to treasuries, and earn 3 basis points or whatever. So you would come up on top. Now, regulatory capital mucks up some of that. And that gets into, I'm sure you've talked about capital arbitrage transactions and so forth, because regulatory rules do not necessarily follow the true economics of the deal. But if we stand back and say, look at this from a true economic standpoint.
But a flip argument also being made, though, is it's because of the same attitude that I can sell credit risk that the current crisis will generate a lot of loan conditions market in those years.
Let's hold that thought for a moment. Sanford used to enjoy speaking to the young bankers as they would come into the institution. Normally there was a trading, recruitment class, and he would show up and talk to them from time to time. Halfway through one of these cycles, he asked one of the young bankers, what's the most interesting thing you've done, or the most important thing you've done since you've been here? And the young guy looked at him and said, I was part of a team that originated a line of credit to IBM for $300 million. That's the biggest thing I've ever done. And Sanford said, let's think about that for a moment. Do you expect that to be funded? And the guy said, no. IBM is a AAA rated company. This is the first line of credit they've ever had. I don't think they're going to draw under it. Sanford said, okay, two things can happen then. They're likely to pay us 3 or 4 basis points for that line of credit, and we'll earn a rate of return of 5 or 6%. On equity on that transaction. Or IBM could get into big trouble, draw down the full $300 million and default. Now you tell me what's good about either one of those outcomes. That's the way, I just throw that out as an example. He was constantly thinking about opportunity costs for deploying the bank's capital. I threw in a couple of examples of the advertisements that were done during that time because I think they were truly revolutionary for a bank, something as staid and conservative as the banking industry, to come up with advertisements like these. Now, let's get back to your question. What happened? These techniques were developed starting in the 1970s. I mean, VAR existed in 1979. It was not really embraced by the industry until 1995 or later. There are thousands of people employed in the risk management profession in major financial institutions. What happened? Is risk management inadequate? There's no one answer to I don't think there's any one answer to these questions, but I'd be interested to know what you think. And clearly you've thought about it.
I don't think we listen to what our knowledge has told us. We thought, well, hey, you know, with the bravado of, you know, the driving markets, but I can ignore what, you know, what I'm being, what the market is doing. My analysis is telling me.
So senior management basically ignored the risk managers in a kind world. So the risk managers were doing the right thing and presenting information that was ignored at the top.
Well,
5 minutes to take. I feel that risk analysis is becoming more quantitative in the sense sometimes the common sense is left aside and you miss the forest for the trees. In a lot of the models, especially credit risk, where it's becoming measured more and more like market risk, looking at wires and so on, that's forgot to see the basic fundamental asset bubble that has been created in the housing market, which I think is the cause of the problem.
And who should have seen that bubble? Other than everybody.
I mean, probably risk management should have seen it, but the tools to see it were not wire, especially historical backward methods of taking distributions or forward distributions, which you just assume normality and so on. But fundamentally, I mean, even if you saw it, I think incentives were misaligned, because if you have people taking in mortgages at a commercial institution and then sort of doing what bankers trust did, which is sell the loan credit exposure on it, and then you tack them onto CMOs, where for the same credit risk of AAAs, you get 50 basis points more. There was this disalignment of interest where there was a continuous appetite for new mortgages, irrespective of whether they were done correctly or not. So I would say greed then becomes like the basic reason. So it's almost like I see a storm, but I really don't care about it, even if it's there. So because I'm sharing the risk, somebody else will take it, But now what I'm realizing as an afterthought is, finally, if you share risk, the effect is worse than if only one person had made a mistake and he died, Like now everyone's close to dying, and then it's personal financial institutions.
That's, in general, regardless of what you say, I'll probably believe part of it. I think there were a lot of things that went wrong. I had been a very, very big proponent of underwrite and distribute. Diversification is one of the few free lunches and the only free lunch I know of in finance, and we should take full advantage of it. Why hold all of the risk in the banks? We know what happens if the banks sit on all the risk. They blow up. Look at the banking industry in my lifetime, since the early 70s, they tend to blow up every 5 years or so, or 10 years. And you can name them, 74, 75, 79, 80, or 81, 82, and then again in 89, 90, 91, 92, and then the dot-com boom in 2000. Banks tend to blow up if we look to the banks to hold that risk. Redistributing that risk, I think, is fundamentally good. And I was involved in some of the loan securitizations that we did at Deutsche Bank. But I personally had no understanding of what was going on in terms of the mortgage underwriting side of it. My institution's not involved in that in terms of originating mortgages. I don't see it day by day. I don't mean to offer excuses, but you've got a full work day just doing your job, and how are you going to go worry about, even though you're a risk person, how do you go worry about stuff that is not on your plate? I think one of the biggest things that should keep risk managers awake at night is what new is going to happen. I mean, at a minimum, we should understand the risks that have blown us up in the past. But the biggest risk is something that has not yet happened before. The next cycle is not going to be just like the last one.
I will add two points. I don't actually think that the models were used were too sophisticated. I think there was a lack of use of proper models. It's always the financial innovation went a lot faster than our ability to model and to capture the risk and for everyone to do that. That's one. Number two, I think some of these products which were meant to distribute the risk did not eventually do that because of some hidden clauses. So the SIVs were the typical problem where the risk eventually was not really out of the balance sheet, came back to the banks to hunt them because in the end they had to guarantee them. So some of the perhaps extra I maybe the party was so big, the music was so loud, and people actually failed to see that some of the instruments were not doing what they were supposed to do at some time. And I think that was one of the other problems. And the other piece, there was a high interest for yield, and how was that measured against the rating? And the rating was fundamentally the wrong measure to look and compare. So people were saying, yes, I get 50 basis points more for a double A, but that double A was not the same as a double A bond. In that sense, I would say we failed to lose some of the right things. I don't think that fundamentally inadequate. We just made big mistakes, I think.
One of the things that I, as a risk person, that really causes me to pause and worry is when you're doing things that you've never done before, that the institution has never done before, you really can't say with 100% confidence that this is going to be risk managed properly. You can do your best, but you can't say with 100% confidence. And second, you don't know what's going to follow behind you. In 1999, we did the first synthetic securitization of loans at Deutsche Bank. And the loan documentation had a rating trigger in it, such that if Deutsche Bank were downgraded below, I don't know what the rating was, the bank would have to post a lot of collateral against the securities that we had issued from the securitization. Now, we went through proper channels. I went to the Treasury guy and said, this is the risk that the bank is moving into. Will you sign off on it? And after proper discussion, he signed off on it. AIG did the same thing. It's just that they did lots of deals like that, and they deals that had rating triggers, so that when they were downgraded, they had to post more collateral than they had capital. And the first one probably wasn't bad. I mean, it was reasonable. But nobody was looking at that and saying, is the firm capable of posting this collateral at any point in time, you know, as we move forward in the future? One point that Stanford used to make is you should manage your business. You should manage the capital as if it's your own capital. RAROC is a good system if you're managing your business, your capital, as if it's your own capital, as if your retirement depends upon it, full stop. As soon as you start managing capital any other way, you don't need RAROC, you don't need anything, you're just going to screw up. I think there's a lot of truth to that. And I think a lot of we're going to go back, and one of the outcomes from this crisis is going to be the truly high-risk prop trading businesses belong in partnerships. They don't belong in publicly traded companies because it's very, very difficult for traders to manage that capital as if it's their own capital. And shareholders should require that they stay out of that business. I think we're going to end up with lower returns in the banking industry. My biggest concern is that we end up with regulation that deters innovation. And I think we're all losers in that. I don't have an answer for what the regulation should be. I'm watching very closely. But I think regulation that does not interfere with innovation is something that we need desperately. Yes?
Have you looked at the Canadian banks, especially regarding profitability? My understanding is, in Canada, it seems like retail business is quite profitable compared to the U.S. I know you're more, from your discussion, you're not towards the trading business, underwriting, commercial banking.
My sense of Canadian banks and you know, don't shoot me. Canadian banks have made mistakes just like U.S. banks have made mistakes in the past. They avoided a lot of this crisis, probably because they, for whatever reason, but was it Toronto Dominion that incurred such large losses in the crisis in 2001-2002, the telecom crisis? CIBC incurred large losses in its investment banking business in the same time. The pecking order, in my mind, the pecking order of Canadian banks has reshuffled significantly over the last 15 years as some of them have incurred losses and others have risen relative to one another. I think Canadian banks are diversified across businesses, meaning high net worth individuals, retail banking, middle market, and some large corporate business. Given the nature of their business, given the nature of regulatory practices, outside firms cannot come in and buy a Canadian bank. So they're protected in this market. There are probably some kind of limits to the amount of business that is either they are allowed to do or is prudent when they go abroad. Yes, the Canadian banks are present in the U.S. in particular niches, but I don't know that they have such a presence that they would be sucked into subprime activities to a large degree. So the other critical thing is that I think a lot of their lending is SME lending, middle market lending, which is somewhat similar to leveraged loans in the sense that these are a little bit more risky than the Fortune 200 companies. They tend to be funded because those customers need banks. They don't issue debt directly into the market, so the bank is more important to them. The largest Canadian banks are present in the international market, but not to the same degree that, say, a Deutsche Bank, a Barclays Capital, and Citibank and JP Morgan Chase would be. Let me ask you one final question to think about. Oh, before I say that, I wrote a little epilogue to the end of that paper in which I tried to answer the question, what happened? And I'm severely constrained because I work for a bank and everything I write has to go through an editor in corporate communication, so I had to watch that carefully. But I came to three conclusions, or identified three points. Number one, models were not the problem. It was not a failure of mathematics or data or models. And I don't think it was necessarily a failure of the people that were running those models that led to this crisis. It's hard to blame mathematics. Mathematics is just a tool. It's hard to blame a model. We all know models have problems. I mean, the worst thing you can do is to assume that a model doesn't have problems. And that's why I think it's insightful to back up and think about where did all this come from and how was it used. Models are used to help us develop our thoughts and communicate our thoughts. They don't provide absolute answers. I had an econometrics professor one time that said, you know, I can't think of anything that you can prove with econometrics. And the same would be true of financial models. Two, I don't think many of the corporate CEOs were good risk managers or risk managers at all. If you look at their background, they didn't rise through the risk side of the bank. When I look at the experience of Bankers Trust and say, why did it work here? One reason, I think, is that Sanford did rise from risk management, basically. Not only was he instrumental in developing these, but he rose by applying risk management throughout the firm as opposed to chasing the next deal, the next bubble in the market. And the third issue is that while all firms today have risk management practices, and most of them have a chief risk officer, I question how much power they really have, and I question the culture of the institution. The point that I tried to make in the epilogue is that risk management did not really become a discipline across the industry until 1995-96, the mid-90s. I mean, yes, there were credit departments always, but did you really have people arguing risk culture in these firms prior to the mid-90s? I don't think so. And I think the reason it happened at that time was because Basel was implemented in 1989, the market risk practices were implemented in 1995. All of a sudden, there were regulatory requirements. We had to do this to satisfy a regulator. It didn't mean changing culture, changing strategy. It simply meant satisfying the regulator. So many firms staffed up in risk management, but they did not really say, how do I use this function to manage my business going forward? One final point to think about. If I were to give, let's go back in time 15 years ago. You get hired by a bank as the loan portfolio manager. Your job is to manage the loan portfolio of the bank. And this is going to have large loans and small loans. It's not going to be diversified. Your compensation is going to be based on the average return on that book over a rolling five-year period. What would you do to manage that position? 15 years ago, there were no credit derivatives. You could not securitize loans. I'll answer this part of it for you. You'll probably take a look, name by name, pick the names that you really thought might default, and sell those positions. Sell them at a loss if you have to. You're destroying the relationship with the customer because you're no longer a lender to that customer. But you're avoiding the loss in event of default. You might reduce certain exposures on some other names at the risk of destroying the relationship, but you think that's prudent business. Beyond that point, there's not much you could do. Go to bed at night and hope that the next morning nobody has defaulted. There's no bad news. Now, if you were given that same book today, same portfolio, except that it is now marked to market, and every name in that book, every obligor, trades in the credit default swap market, what would you do? How much? I mean, keep in mind, every dollar that you buy protection is just reducing your revenue. Would you neutralize the book?
Depends on the part, right? If you manage, you know, so as you said, it used to be sell the name, if you separated a credit book, you buy full protection on its name, it still is a relationship, so you can default and still revisit it, but protect it from realizing.
Very good answer. My answer to that is that you'd look through the book and you would basically reduce your net open exposure on every position until you're left with a position that you could get out of within a period of 3 to 5 days by trading. And it's really back to the original thoughts that Sanford had in the early 1970s. I don't want to be stuck in an illiquid position when the market turns down. And then you can overhedge or hedge absolutely neutralized positions if you have a negative view on that name, and today we can buy indices to manage the market risk of the total book in terms of the expectation of whether spreads are going to widen or contract.
Yes. I agree with that. The only fundamental problem I have is when there is a problem which engulfs the market and you have credit derivatives on the side, and our counterpart is themselves a problem. How good are those credit derivatives in neutralizing a lot of the risk that you have? I sort of separated during normal market conditions and during problematic market conditions. I find that problem not only with credit derivatives, but also diversification. The correlation, it's almost like the free lunch during normal times becomes a not free lunch during market problems, where everything is not correlated together, as we saw even during this crisis. How good do these, are there limitations in some of the ways we look at markets currently?
I would be deceiving myself and you if I said there are no limitations. I mean, markets are not perfect. We like to think perfect markets, but they are not perfect. On the other hand, credit derivatives have worked, and we do not have a situation where, I do not know of a situation where the customer has defaulted and we've not been able to collect under the derivative. Now, did we properly? The bigger issue becomes one of basis risk, where you can't exactly hedge this obligor, but you hedge a related entity, or you hedge somebody else in the market that looks a lot like him, and you don't have a perfect hedge, and you incur basis risk in those cases. That's frequently a problem. Personally, I think single name credit derivatives are solid products, and I think that I think they're functioning. Correlation bets are quite a different issue. I don't think we understand correlation well enough. And Dan said a minute ago something like, this is a case where the market got ahead of the analytics. People were trading correlation, but the models didn't give me a lot of comfort that we really understood what was determining correlation. We could infer correlation at a point in time, but we didn't understand what it's going to do if the environment changed. And one thing we do know is that correlation goes to one in a crisis and everything is independent. So your concept of a portfolio becomes less effective.
Great.
Great question. I think if you ask the original pioneers, Sanford and some of his close colleagues, they would say, oh, you should use it all the time. It's difficult to implement because it's an abstract concept. And second, it's not something that is necessarily recognized in the market. For example, in compensation. Ideally, what you do, I firmly believe you want to compensate people based upon risk-adjusted performance. And to be honest, if we had compensated people prior to this crisis on risk-adjusted performance, we never would have paid them what we did. They were running tremendous risk. They didn't recognize it. We didn't recognize it. But I think if you really stood back and said, this person that earned $50 million in 1 year, did he create $50 million worth of value? That's hard to swallow in any environment. So I think you are constrained by the market. While ideally you'd like to pay on a risk-adjusted basis, if you do that as best you can, and that person feels like he's not properly compensated, he'll leave and go somewhere else. So you're constrained by the market in that sense. The way we use economic capital at Deutsche Bank is primarily in a strategic planning process, first and foremost. Well, we use it in several ways. I think the way it has contributed most to the bank is in a strategic planning process where we look at risk-adjusted returns on capital every year, and we set limits for the different business units. So we have, in fact, moved capital away from low-performing businesses to make it available for higher-performing businesses. A certain amount of internal competition for capital is very good for the bank, as long as there's a process around it. And this is done at the highest level of the bank. Second is for illiquid products. We did go through a process of calculating RAROC for loans, and did this achieve the desired hurdle rate or not? And the bank never got the backbone, the discipline, to say, okay, if it doesn't achieve the hurdle rate, what do we do? Some banks say if it doesn't achieve the hurdle rate, you have to pay the bank. You have to pay for that shortfall. Others say we're going to simply keep a record of it, and at the end of the year, we'll see if you've made it up in selling other products, cross-selling other products. So it was used in a transaction basis that way. Today at Deutsche Bank, we fair value over 50% of our large corporate loans. So they're reported on a mark-to-market basis. When the loan is originated, we calculate the fair value at origination. The loan portfolio group, loan exposure management group, says we will buy that loan at the cost to hedge. So if it's originated at a discount, and most of these are, you business sponsor must pay us the difference. So they end up paying us a lot of money. At origination, though, we have enough money to hedge that loan completely. So it's a market transaction. And by pricing it to market, it basically says to the loan originator, the sponsoring business unit, you can pick the customers, you can size the loan. That's your business. But you're going to have to pay the market price of bringing credit risk into the bank. And the only reason you should be bringing that type of credit risk into the bank at a discount is if you think you can cross-sell other products to make it up. So what you're doing is valuing that long-term relationship when you originate that loan. Any other questions?
Just a sub-question. So when you hedge the risk, so you hedge it at a portfolio level, for example, if you got four loans, you would take them together, find what the net gap is, and then hedge only the net.
No.
Otherwise, it's unfair to take an individual loan and say, here's the interest rate hedging cost for that loan by itself, if overall it helped to reduce interest rate risk on a portfolio level.
Okay, that's a very, very important point, and I feel like I probably spent a lot of my career trying to argue that point unsuccessfully. In the end, it's very important to keep rules very simple and very transparent so that you can communicate them to analysts and shareholders. We have, for every customer group, based on the rating of the customer group, we have a maximum open loan exposure that we may hold. And people ask me, well, we haven't released those numbers, but people ask me, how do you size that? And the only way I can say is that it really gets back to, if this name is completely liquid, how much exposure should I be holding? What's the maximum exposure I can hold that I feel like I could get out of or hedge within a period of 4 or 5 days? So our maximum open exposure is well below €1 billion. We know at origination, if we originate €1 billion loan for an acquisition finance, we know we have to hedge that, and we have 90 days to do it. So we start hedging on a single name basis. Then we look at the total portfolio, and we look at the sensitivity of the loan risk versus the hedge risk, and we use credit derivatives to balance that, so that we are managing the total P&L of the book. The beauty of that, and I honestly thought we could do much better than that when it was first decided. The beauty of it is that the chief risk officer can go to analysts and say, we have maximum thresholds to all of our obligors, and none of them exceed these thresholds. No exposure in the book exceeds these thresholds. Unless it's because it's highly illiquid and it's a bridge loan and we're working it down. An analyst picked up on that and said, based on that, we're going to reduce the loan loss provisions that we're assuming for Deutsche Bank over the next 3 years, and we estimate these hedges are worth €3 billion. Now, if we had used a far more complex rule to communicate this hedging activity, he would not have been able to estimate its value. And that's a ballpark number, but I think there's value in keeping it simple. So there's a trade-off there. Any other questions?
Perhaps one last good question. So you talked a lot about the history of risk management, what happened before the crisis and throughout the crisis. Can you give us maybe your final thoughts of what's in it for the next 5 years, or what's your view of how risk management will come out of the crisis, and perhaps it's interplay with regulation? I know it's a complex
thing,
but
the one thing that I honestly believe is that I think risk managers will rise higher in the corporate structure. I think that experience, and it's a The Germans have an expression, fingertip kind of experiential feel, that is needed in the top management team. And so I think in the future it will be valued much higher. So I think that risk managers will have greater opportunities to rise in the corporate structure. When that happens, I think that we'll see the risk that someone mentioned of risk managers doing their job but not being properly heard in the institutions will decline over time. I think there's always this bubble concept in financial institutions, especially banks, and herd behavior, that you don't want, when everybody's earning money, you don't want to be left out because your shareholders are not going to accept that, especially when these tranches are rated AAA. So I think that it is a case where the market got far ahead of the analytics, and I think the market has to correct. I think that there will still be a lot of opportunity for financial engineering people and people that can think analytically and build these models. I think risk managers should challenge themselves to better communicate what the risks are. It's not just a VAR number, but we have to put it in the context of where we are. And as I said, the biggest risk is a risk that we've not yet seen before. So that's always a challenge. The regulatory issue concerns me a great deal because politicians are going to have to respond to this crisis. They have to show results of shaking things up in some way. I don't know what the outcome is going to be. In the U.S., I would assume that the multiple regulatory agencies are going to be integrated in some way. So there will be the Feds likely to emerge as the supreme regulator responsible for the health of the financial system. But I know that there is tremendous resistance from the different agencies to facing any change whatsoever. I am very concerned that regulation will not only result in significantly lower returns in the industry, but also cause a brain drain to leave the industry and innovation to decline.
So thank you very much for
thank you.